Well, hello once again, Worst Foot Forward listeners. A very merry Bank Holiday Monday if you're listening in the United Kingdom. If you're not listening in the United Kingdom, bad luck. We've all got the day off work today. Just three quick things. Firstly, to say hello to our listeners in Vietnam, because this week we reached the top 10 comedy podcasts in Vietnam. As always happens when we pop up in the charts in a non-English speaking country, myself and Barry are fascinated. So if you live in Vietnam and you listen to our podcast, drop us an email at worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com or say hello on Twitter at worstfoot. Second thing to say is we've been banging on a lot recently about supporting us on Patreon, which you're very welcome to do. But if you're someone who thinks, I love the podcast, I want to support them, but not with money, or I'm too skint to, then a brilliant way to support us is to pop onto your podcasting app of choice, whether it be iTunes, Castbox, or anything else. Give us a rate and a review and a subscribe. Those are the things that make the magical algorithms very happy indeed. If you don't want to pop to Patreon to subscribe for extra content and the chance to have input into how the show goes, you can do so for as little as $2 a month on patreon.com/worstfootforward. This episode this week was suggested by one of our dearest Patreon supporters. Last of all, next week's episode, we've got another brilliant comedian on called Chloe Petz, and we'll be talking about the world's worst mascot, bringing you all sorts of humanity, from daft wartime propaganda to really inappropriate people dressed and behaving very inappropriately at sporting events. Anyway, that's next week. This week, time to get into the laboratory and do some very bad science. Welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find us in the top secret Worst Foot Forward laboratory, where we're currently working on the Fool's Stone and Philosopher's Gold. The former is a rare ore which can enable the holder of it to talk in punchlines. It's rumoured that Tim Vine has a pair of underpants fashioned from it, whilst the latter is a precious element which, whilst enriching the bearer unimaginably, makes them question their very existence. But these are just petty little hobbies which distract us from the main business of the lab, grafting a full-grown mouse onto the human ear. It's a great leap forward, which will mean that future bioengineered humans will be able to not just taste and smell a cheese board, but also hear it as well. Good Lord, Barry, this Brie sounds like Beethoven, he said in the most middle-class sentence ever. And with me is the emeritus professor to my meritless professing, Barry McStay.
I would, because do you know the way wine tasters have that thing of going, oh, describing wine in really the tones that they have?
Yep.
Imagine if cheese did have, like, its own language.
Cheese must have its own language.
But in musical tones, like in a more synesthetic version than just, oh, it's got fruity on its own, or nutty. Knotty sidebars.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that blue cheese would sound like
the blues.
Sound like muddy waters.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
And then, what do you reckon Stinking Bishop would sound like?
Captain Beefheart. The problem is that you get some sort of like new radical young cheesemonger be like, oh, I've made really punky cheese. It's just cheddar, mate. It's just cheddar. Get over yourself.
I've shredded. He's really shredding. Yeah. Halloumi obviously just sounds like Zorba the Greek.
Yeah, yeah.
Our guest this week is a comedian who started writing and performing on the comedy circuit at the age of 15. He's played many, many festivals and has several Edinburgh Fringe shows under his belt, including 2018's Housewives Favourite, where he reassessed all his emotional relationships with jokes. He also created Hell to Play, the comedy game show set in Hell, whose entire cast had to be replaced in his first attempt to stage it, presumably for being too saintly. And as a cartoonist and filmmaker, he's been guest lecturer at the Royal College of Art, Now, for his comedy, though, he has won praise from Steve Appleby at The Guardian, who called him warm and insane, notorious comedy critics Chortle, who called him touched with madness, and he's been called witty, weird and dark by comedy legend Harry Hill, which all goes to show that comedy reviewing in the UK is weirdly backhanded with its compliments. Please welcome Alexander Bennett.
Thank you very much for having me. I am the housewife's favourite.
Who is your favourite housewife? Or do we have to see the show? Did you have a new one each show?
I mean,
Maureen from Blackpool.
Do you know what? I did have a. I put this on Twitter afterwards. I said, thank you. One day during the Fringe, I said, thank you very much to the quartet of drunken MILFs that came to see my show today. You're not really my target audience, not for comedy anyway.
The quartet of drunken MILFs, of course, supported the three tenors
on the alternate version of the 12 Days of Christmas. A quartet of drunken MILFs. Three tenors. The Everly Brothers. And Celine Dion in a pear tree. Yeah.
If they were my true love, they would give me a quartet of drunken MILFs.
Could they all fit inside a Christmas sock? I always forget the name for it. Thank you.
Stocking. Christmas sock. Shit, your Judaism holding you back yet again. Yeah.
The Christmas.
Or maybe your parents just did. They did one of those thought experiments where from your childhood they've called it a Christmas sock. Yeah. Like telling your child a knife is a fork and a fork is a knife.
Yeah, they did that, and they would also, like, whereas others would be filled with like trinkets and toys, mine would just be full of marbles and bricks, and they would beat me with it until I denied Christ as our Lord and Saviour.
Christmas sock. Who's the jolly fat man who has that red and white yarmulke on his head? That's Father Christmas.
Carrying his Christmas bag for life to put little gifts into the Christmas sock and leave it under the Christmas bush.
Yeah. Why has he got those horned donkeys pulling his wheelless car? It's one of those words that I genuinely struggle to remember.
Stocking.
Thank you. I was really struggling with it.
This is why you were such a bad burlesque dancer, wasn't it? Yeah. Watch me remove my Christmas socks. Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. I made you out of clay. Dreidel, dreidel, dreidel.
Pair of nipple tassels like dreidels.
Yeah. Don't call them nipple tassels. Call them breast mustaches. I like that this episode's going out in May. We're getting all the Christmas stuff out.
The Christmas
comes earlier every year. Alexander, we always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. What would that be for you?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of things I'm bad at. I'm not good on the phone, but genuinely, falling asleep. So I'm not an insomniac, because a true insomniac can't sleep. Once I'm gone, I'm very, very pleased being unconscious. Actually falling asleep, I just can't.
What holds you back?
The relentless carnival of nonsense in my brain. I don't understand how other people fall asleep. I can't fall asleep on any transport. That includes over 24-hour flights to Australia.
Oh, yeah.
Just can't do it, which is, one of the stirring factors in my relentless alcoholism. let's get this quiet enough so daddy can fall asleep.
Single-handedly keeping Qantas afloat, all those long distance flights, drinking them dry.
Yeah.
I lived in Australia for a year, and I flew back at one point to Ireland. And I can't sleep on airplanes. And so I spent the entire 24 hours from Sydney to Heathrow bashing my way through the entire first series of Will and Grace, which was where I did the entire thing. I'd never been into Will and Grace, but it seemed like the only, I don't know, in a very poor smorgasbord of options on their in-flight viewing, I was like, that'll do, and just... Just let it keep running.
It's not a great endorsement that we basically went, the only time I will watch this series is if I am trapped 40,000 feet above the planet Earth.
If the only thing saving me from certain death is a thin layer of metal.
Yeah. You know when you're in a plane, like a high altitude, high pressure, the effects of alcohol increases.
Yes.
And people are often more emotional on planes because of weird effects on your body. It's like Will and Grace comes across as sort of more catty and bitchy. Like, it increases in like all... it all seems like, wow, they've really got acid tongues.
Oh, you say that actually Karen is sober at sea level.
They were all straight when the plane took off.
I mean, that sounds like a Victorian scientist.
I wonder if altitude increases homosexuality. Let's all go up in this balloon. My word, I'm having some urges.
This week, listeners, we are talking about the world's worst scientific fraud, and we're doing so at the behest of one of our Patreon supporters, the excellent Anna Seddon, who's been supporting us for a number of months, not raising any eyebrows at the rest of you. but she works as a scientist. I think she works in the world of physics. Mm-hmm. I can't quite remember the nitty-gritty of what it is, but it's something very complicated that I don't really understand the use of, but apparently is for the general good of humankind. I'm sorry for talking
about
your job.
Well, buddy. You're doing so well.
Yeah,
we'll get back into the arts in the next episode.
Yeah. we're all very proud of what you're doing, Anna. And more importantly, she asked us to do this topic, which is what we are going to do, and we're going to begin by Barry. What scientific frauds did you find?
I found the world record for the most fabricated data in scientific papers.
Wow, isn't the person who did the most fabricated papers or the most in one paper?
Yeah, the most fabricated papers. A guy called Yoshitaka Fuji is a Japanese researcher into anesthesiology. And in 2012, there was a study done into 212 of the papers he'd submitted to various scientific journals, and 183 of them were found to have had fabricated data in them. He had quite good credentials. He graduated from Tokai University School of Medicine in the 80s. He has an MD. He attended a graduate school of medical and dental sciences, Tokyo Medical and Dental University. He had a PhD. He'd worked in various institutions in Japan. And the main subject of his research was clinical trials of medications that treat nausea and vomiting that often occurs after surgery. So I love PhDs and how specific they are. It's nausea and vomiting, but only after surgery.
So is that after performing surgery, or looked at someone's insides for 4.5 hours?
It's a really high turnover in surgery.
Yeah.
So studying feelings of nausea after putting your hand in all the gross icky bits that are in people's chests.
Yeah, you never see that. That's why they have to knock you out. It's not like because you'll be in pain. It's because you just have a surgeon over going.
Yeah. You're asleep, so they can go, oh my god, what's that? That's gross.
Concerns about his papers had been raised as far back as the year 2000. Various people had written to a journal questioning some of his findings regarding the effectiveness of a drug called granizotron, and they characterised the data reported in some of the papers as incredibly nice. And said, we became sceptical when we realised that the side effects were almost always identical in all groups. He basically copied and pasted all of this stuff. And he dismissed, Fuji dismissed this criticism, saying the results were true, and asked, how much evidence is required to provide adequate proof?
I hope he didn't get that voice well. How much evidence do you
have? That is such a great thing for a doctor and a scientist to say. How much evidence do you need?
Yeah. And this is in the year 2000. I mean, 20 years later, the answer is basically none, apparently. The editors of the journal Anesthesia and Analgesia didn't follow up these allegations for another 10 years. And they then went, oh, hang on, maybe actually you were right. And they produced some analyses of Fuji's publications. And as I say, they released in 2012. One found that although 9 of his publications were about clinical studies that were described as having been conducted at one particular hospital, the hospital's ethics committee had given him approval for only one study. So he just had added on 8 more. He also apparently was deliberately ambiguous about details such as the dates of the studies, the names of the institutions where they were conducted, and he would also list co-authors from institutions other than his current employer so that they wouldn't know he'd cited them, and apparently seemingly forged the signatures of a couple of people in a cover letter when submitting one paper to the journal as well. So he really doubled down on it, I have to say. You'd be glad to know, though, of all of these papers, 3 of them were found to be valid. of the 212.
See, he's not such a bad scientist after all.
Yeah, I mean, that's about 1%. Yeah. Who hasn't?
I like the idea of crediting people in a different institution because they won't find out. I should take this opportunity to say, Ben, whenever any of my jokes die on stage, I say, oh, that's Ben Vandervelde wrote that for me. I credit it to a different source.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So if they have any issues, you can take it up with
more people. Comedy should have footnotes, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Certainly when I do it, I mean, it's very much...
It's all footnotes.
It feels like a medical experiment.
I like the idea of annotated comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, kind of like you doing a comedy show and just like me and Barry sat by the side with microphones doing the director's commentary that people can switch on and off as they play.
That'd be like, a silent disco comedy gig.
Annotated comedy. I don't know if you've ever gigged in Essex, but you will get footnotes given to you.
Yeah. I also read... Now, I remember a few weeks ago we did the world's worst algorithm.
Yeah.
We talked about computer-generated poetry and computer-generated jokes. Computer-generated scientific articles, Ben.
Oh dear.
I read about a guy called Philip Davis, who was a graduate student at Cornell University in New York. And he kept getting spam email from this publisher of scientific journals, Bentham Science Publishers. And he just was really, really annoyed by the amount of emails he was getting from them. And then he was also invited to serve on the editorial board for some of the journals they published, for which he was told he would be allowed to publish one free article a year. But he was kept getting solicitations for journals in which he had no expertise whatsoever. So they were clear. He said it really painted a picture of vanity publishing. They were just like, oh, we published all these things, that would be great. But actually, it's all a bit rubbish, and he's just getting people attached to these papers or attached to their publications who aren't qualified in the field in which they're meant to be specialising. Yeah,
it's the LinkedIn of scientific
data. Yes, very much so. He also really resented Bentham because they charge publication fees. Yeah. They publish freely, but they get the people who contribute to pay them to publish their work.
Oh, it's like a bringer gig.
Yes.
Yeah, pay to play.
Yeah, pay to play. And so he teamed up with a guy called Kent Anderson, and they used a program called SciGen, a program that generates nonsensical computer science papers. They created a paper called Deconstructing Access Points. And here's a sample paragraph. In this section, we discuss existing research into red-black trees, vacuum tubes, and courseware, brackets 10. On a similar note, recent work by Takahashi suggests a methodology for providing robust modalities, but does not offer an implementation, brackets 9.
What?
Yeah, exactly, Ben. It's complete bollocks. It doesn't make any sense. And yet, writing under their nom de plume, they managed to get accepted to be published in the Open Information Science Journal, one of Bentham's journals. Their nom de plume, they also attached themselves to an institute when they submitted it, the Centre for Research in Applied Phrenology.
Phrenology, is phrenology not the study of what people's skulls are shaped like?
Yeah.
Which is massive quack science.
That's massive quack science, and the Centre for Research in Applied Phrenology, its acronym is CRAP, guys. they were contacted by the publishers, as I say, and asked to send the publication fee of $800 to be sent to a P.O. box in the United Arab Emirates. Having made his point, Davis withdrew the paper. It wasn't actually published. Mahmoud Alam, Bentham's director of publications, responded to the New Scientist querying the whole story, saying, in this particular case, we were aware that the article submitted was a hoax, and we tried to find out the identity of the individual by pretending the article had been accepted. Davis said, why hasn't he attempted to contact me directly then?
I knew you were joking.
All the time. I just played along.
I was upset.
I have one quick mention before I get to my main suggestion for Piltdown Man. Discovered by Charles Dawson in 1912, he found some, what he said were the remains of an early hominid, and he wrote to...
Hominid, not humanid.
He wrote for early hominid, yes, not a hominid. He wrote to...
if he'd call it a hominid, like, that's a red flag that was a hoax straight away.
Yeah, straight away.
But Charles Dawson was it 1912?
1912, yeah.
Didn't, you know, that name and that era, does it not just sound like... Yeah, of course, Charles Dawson in 1912 made some kind of scientific discovery.
Yeah, that's right.
I would expect, if I was called Charles Dawson in 1912, I would expect to walk out of my house and stumble over fossils or some as yet undiscovered tribe or burial ground.
Yeah, they were everywhere at the time. Yeah.
It's those blokes of a particular period that I imagine just smoking a pipe and
looking
going,
at rocks.
What wonders did the world have to offer me today?
Darling, I'm just going out. I've got 17 species to discover by lunchtime.
Yeah. I've seen an interesting bird on the offside of the street and I want to know where it's come from.
Yes, he wrote to Arthur Smith Woodward, who was the curator of geology at the Natural History Museum in London. And he said, I found these pieces of bone, and they did some more digging, found a few more bits and some tools, and they said this was the missing link between ape and man. Lived up to 500,000 years ago. They called it Eoanthropus Dawsoni, after himself, of course. And crucially, they said it was older even than Heidelberg man. The Bally Germans had found the earliest man up to that point, and hey, we were 2 years out from World War I. The Brits weren't going to let them rest on that laurel for too long.
Your country needs you. Are you a dead fossilized farmer lying in a peat bog for 1,000 years? Your country, these Germans are saying that the master race, so-called, has been around longer than us Brits. Well, if you're lying perfectly preserved in a piece of ice on the side of a mountain and you still have hair and skin for some reason, your Kitchener needs you to join the war effort. Let's get you. You can be on tour with Dame Vera Lynn. You'll meet again with a songstress of the stars and you can rot in front of our brave boys. We won't have these jellies.
Is that why they dug all those trenches? They were just trying to find more fossils.
Older and older dead British people. I think we found one, Sergeant. Looks suspiciously French to me. Throw him in the fire.
Well, to avoid any question about the Britishness of this particular fossil, they also said they gave
him a stiff moustache.
They said they found his cricket bat.
Come on!
Genuinely.
We found his cricket bat and his cover of the Radio Times.
This is clearly a hoax. This cricket bat is made out of mammoth ivory.
they go to Greece, dig up some ancient pots and go, well, clearly the British have been here and collected these for a museum.
He must be British because he had cricket equipment.
It was a huge elephant bone, which naturally you'd find in a bog in Sussex or a quarry, wherever they found this. People did point out, as early as 1913, the following year, that his humanoid skull had a very ape-like jaw. So, and the theory at the time was that we evolved upwards, if you like. So started at the bottom and became more and more human as we got up to the top. Dawson, a couple more years later, found some more piltdown figures. So, you know, doubled down on the whole thing. Mm. It wasn't until about 50 years later that people sort of got a proper look at these things and debunked the whole story in 1953. He had just stuck, you guessed it, an ape jaw onto a human skull.
Yeah.
In fact,
I need to make him look more British. Let me make him look more like an ape.
Yeah.
But an ape that crucially plays cricket.
Yeah. Monkey cricket.
Yeah. He's Alan Partridge. Yeah. Monkey tennis.
Yeah. He had just stained the bones brown and filled the cracks with gravel and did.
Harry, he stained them brown. What? By dipping them in tea and putting them in the oven like we did with our homework when we were eight?
Presumably so.
Sorry, not all homework that we did specifically went to age or things. It's like, this maths homework is strangely antiquated.
It's from the original Euclid.
Yeah.
What happened to your homework? My dog dyed it with tea.
But my world's worst scientific fraud is a story about extracting gold from the sea. According to the National Ocean Services, the oceans hold about 20 million pounds of gold suspended in seawater. But it's very hard to get hold of because each litre of seawater contains about 13 billionths of a gram of gold. So you have to do quite a lot of sedging to get it out. When the British chemist Edward Sonstad discovered there was gold in seawater in the 1870s, there have been people to various degrees of success slash honesty who have tried to extract it since then. I bring you to Maine in America in the 1890s, where a chap called Prescott Ford Jernigan, a Baptist minister.
But say the Reverend.
The Reverend Prescott Ford Jernigan, indeed. And a chap called Charles Fisher. They arrived at a town called Lubeck in Maine and immediately leased a mill. They said that they were going to find gold by sedging the water that was passing through the mill. According to the Reverend Jernigan, millions of dollars in gold were flowing through Lubeck Narrows every single day. And he and Fisher founded the Electrolytic Marine Salts Company, which sounds completely legit. And they said they'd extract millions of dollars of gold from their seawater that raced through the creek. They said the narrows there made it quite... the swift tides, and it was very high, and it was good boat service, and all of this made it perfect for getting for getting gold out of the water. It was also conveniently quite far away from big cities where curious shareholders might want to have a look at their investment. So between the end of 1897, start of 1898, they employed about 100 men converting the mill into a gold extraction factory with a machine room and a laboratory. The article I read about this has all of these words in inverted commas, by the way.
Gold extraction factory is the sign I have above the door of the room I do my writing in.
Yes! In the water beneath the mill, they placed these wooden boxes called accumulators for collecting the gold, and there were lots of high wooden fences and barbed wire and no admittance signs, like properly, like Stranger Things compounds.
We're getting gold out of water.
Yeah. they got a lot of local interest, and there was a lot of excitement about it, and they sold thousands of shares, largely to investors in Massachusetts and New York and Connecticut, and they claimed in their prospectus that one is at a loss to comprehend the enormous wealth floating in solution in the ocean. At the lowest estimate, a cubic mile of seawater contains gold to the value of $65 million. It's probably nearer the mark to place it at $100 million. The big numbers for the 1890s. So successful, apparently, was this first plant at getting water at getting gold out, that they started building another one, employing more and more men. They said it was going to have 5,000 accumulators, 700 labourers were involved in the construction. A lot of Italian immigrants flooded to the area to get work.
It sort of sounds like they were trying to create their own oil rush.
I quote here from the Lubeck Herald: "The presence of these people," and this is a profile on Jernigan and Fisher, "the presence of these people is not only desirable for the amount of money they will bring into the town, but we should welcome them for their social qualities. The officers of the company are earnest Christian gentlemen, and many of their employees are Christians. We wish them all success in their undertaking, and hope that they will take millions of dollars from old Passamaquoddy Bay, and we believe they will. With quantities of gold in the salt water, there is little need of a trip to Alaska," where the Alaskan gold rush was happening at the time. The crucial difference, of course, being that there was gold in Alaska. In summer 1898, rumours began to circulate that all was not quite well. Work was suspended. Jernigan and Fisher had unexpectedly / completely expectedly vanished.
There's nothing to see here.
Yeah.
And now there isn't.
Yeah. Loads of people, obviously townsfolk immediately out of a job, investors losing their money. Jernigan was sailing under an assumed name to France at the time. Fisher completely vanished, never heard of again.
Yeah.
And apparently the story came out that Fisher was a diver, and in fact he would be diving down into the accumulators and salting it with gold, and so then they would extract the gold and bring the gold to New York or somewhere to have it valued and checked, and they go, oh yeah, it's clearly working. Yeah. And encourage more and more people to put money into it. The Boston Herald said, "Never did a fisherman bait his traps with more alluring or attractive morsels than did Reverend P.F. Jernigan tickle the fancy and stimulate the greed of victims with his brilliant and enticing prospectus of the Electrolytic Marine Salts Company, now a practically defunct organisation, with the Reverend promoter flown to foreign parts, an alleged swindle of the first magnitude." A sort of grudging respect there from the Boston Herald.
Yeah,
but obviously...
Say what you like about the gentleman, he was an American entrepreneur.
Yeah. It's the sort of thing that makes America.
Yeah.
Jernigan did return $75,000 to his investors, and the sale of the company's assets enabled them to recover about 36 cents on the dollar. He went on, the article finishes, to become a respected school teacher in the Philippines, where he authored a history of the islands.
Oh dear, there's nothing that strikes more fear and suspicion into me than a respectable Christian gentleman who then becomes a teacher in the Philippines. world's worst scientific fraud. So there's a couple of ways in which we can interpret that. And obviously sort of, shysters and con men. This is the area that we're in. I had one of the things I found was the Cardiff Giant.
Oh, yes.
Which is a it's a supposed sort of discovered giant fossil that was discovered in Cardiff in New York in 1869, and it actually it turned out it was created by George Hull, who was an atheist who decided to create the giant as a joke on fundamentalist minister Mr. Turk, who believed that the Bible told of literal giants who roamed the earth, so he made this giant fossil. I just like the relationship between George Hull and Mr. Turk, which is a sort of Dennis the Menace sort of scenario. Another giant fossil again.
That's a lot of. I mean, I don't know how much money it'd cost to make a nice sculpture in the 1960s, but it's a lot of effort to put into a practical joke.
In the 1860s.
In the 1860s,
indeed. Yes, I'm also slightly unaware of which part of the Bible tells of giants roaming the earth. Or is that Slingshot, what's the...
Goliath.
David and Goliath. So before Moses led the Israelites into Israel, when it was called... Oh, holy Christ, it wasn't called Judah. It was called...
Canaan.
Thank you, Canaan. Ah, God bless your Jesuit education. That is the sound that you would hear in class.
That was the sound of Barry slapping a Jew.
That's what they did instead of high fives in Jesuit school. Before Moses led the Israelites into the land of Canaan, it was apparently full of giants. There's a story... This is one of the things that put me off religion, because the story was that Moses sent some spies into Canaan, go, right, get the lay of the land, see what it's like. And they came back and went, it's full of fucking giants, boss. And half the Israelites were like, right, fuck this, we don't want to go in there anymore. And God basically went, right, well, you're not allowed in my treehouse anymore.
Is that why that's why the Red Sea was such a problem for the Jews, because they're normal size, whereas the giants could just walk through it without having to part it.
Yeah,
the heads would be above water.
Yeah. Exactly, for the giants, which is known as the Red Puddle.
Yeah.
So that's why it was created. But while George Hull was sort of perpetuating this hoax, it became so popular that P.T. Barnum,
of course,
offered £60,000 for a 3-month lease of the sort of created fossil. And he got turned down by George Hull, so he made his own fake fossil, which he put on display. So George Hull tried to sue him, and is going, that's not the real fake. My fake is the real fake.
That's so good.
And in the court case, the judge said if George Hull could prove his giant to be real, then he would have a case, but if it wasn't real, then he didn't have a case, because it's a fake reproduction of a fake thing.
Yeah.
So I just like the, you know, masks behind masks going, it's not real, and a judge going, let's just fucking get some reality on this situation.
I like that reasoning, because if you apply that to modern standards, you could have someone basically copy the Harry Potter books, and yes. J.K. Rowling could try and sue them, and they go, no, if you can prove that your magician actually does magic,
yeah,
then it's fine. Yeah. But if you can't, they're just both fake wizards.
Yes, prove Harry Potter's real. He's secretly gay. That's not what you were saying, J.K. Rowling.
He fists owls. Stop telling us stuff.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dobby's a Holocaust denier. J.K. Rowling, stop coming to the wider world. We don't need backstory.
Dobby's a Holocaust denier.
Yeah, he is not welcome in Gringotts.
Is that why he becomes free when you give him a piece of clothing? It's just and hand him a shoe. I like the Cardiff giant. That's a more obvious.
What do they make it from?
I don't have that detail.
Like, it was like, there's clearly a real giant made from old shoe boxes and a tennis racket.
What, it was an early Blue Peter project.
Please get an animal to help you perpetuate this hoax.
What it was instead of an ordinary fossil, it was the fossil of two dwarves in a train.
much cooler. Wearing the first trench coat.
So that's kind of a more obvious hoax. It's sort of an older idea of science, because in a sort of similar kind of way to alchemy, creating gold as being this sort of lofty purpose, achieving perpetual motion was a scientific thing that almost kind of took on a mythical quality as well. And a gentleman by the name of Charles Redheffer. Charles Redheffer.
Great name.
Trustworthy chap. He raised large sums of money in Philadelphia with his perpetual motion.
His perpetual motion
machine. I mean, I'm reading it now. Charles Redheffer's perpetual motion machine sounds like the greatest disco group for the evening.
Doing mimosas while perpetual motion.
So he raised money and took it to New York in 1813, where people would pay lots of money to see it, and then this is where he fell down. He offered skeptics a large sum of money.
Sorry. When he fell down, but he got immediately back up again.
And then he fell down and got back up again. So he offered some skeptics some money and said, "Prove me wrong." So these skeptics went, "Okay," and all they did was remove two boards that went into the wall that part of the machine was plugged into.
Oh, really?
And reading from the article, behind the boards there was a belt drive just going to a man, an old man who was turning it on a crank, who was also eating a loaf of bread.
Wow. like the video for Shiny Happy People by R.E.M. Yeah, where it goes behind the screen.
Exactly, yes.
It's a very niche reference, but 10 people who've seen that video.
Yeah. A very brief mention before I get to my actual pick of the Sokal hoax. So in...
sounds like an Indiana Jones. It does.
In 1996, American physicist Alan Sokal submitted a paper loaded with nonsensical jargon to the journal Social Text, in which he argued that quantum gravity is a social and linguistic construct, which I just I love as just gravity only exists because we say that it exists. it's you've taken a physical force and turned it into a theoretical thing. And then when it was published, he said, "This is a joke, and I'm proving a point about the things that get published."
Nice. I bet he was so happy.
Oh, delirious.
I bet he was really smug about that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's like, look at me tricking the science. Oh,
this is really hilarious because I got a really long theoretical physics article.
Yeah.
Sit and wait, bide my time, Nature magazine.
Yeah, very much one of those gags that's funnier in retrospect.
Yeah.
He wrote a very long paper.
It wasn't that you had to be there.
Yeah.
It was that you didn't have to be there.
Yeah. Yes. Worst scientific fraud. You can interpret that in the person who is worst at it, or worse in terms of actual impact on the world. There are various charlatans who have sold sort of fake AIDS medication in Africa as a continent. Lots of people have done a great deal of harm. But my pick for worst scientific fraud is homeopathy.
As yay! Glad to hear it.
I've been waiting backstage on this show for a long time.
So homeopathy is based on ideas created by a German, I'm not even going to call him a scientist, a German person by the name of Samuel Heinemann, I think is how you pronounce his name, who was a 19th century doer of things, and but part of the reasons he developed homeopathy. So a lot of the medical treatments in the before the 20th century, the scientific process was still being refined. It's existed in a very pure form for a very long time. Loads of people weren't following it. Existed. It wasn't being refined, but it's just no one was doing it. And a lot of medical treatments caused more harm than good. So you think about bloodletting and things like that. It's a lot of medical treatments made patients actively worse. And what Heinemann wanted to do was create a treatment that was very unintrusive. So he decided that water has magic powers.
It has gold in it.
It has gold. Yes. Yes, if you filter enough gold, eventually you feel golden.
Oh, I bet that the Reverend Prescott Fur Jernigan was a homeopathist.
Yes.
We only need the 1 billionth of a gram of gold anyway.
Yes. So.
Yeah, but the problem is he tried to pay for things with 1 billionth of a gram of gold. But that 1 billionth of a gram of gold is worth $5 billion.
So he created homeopathy. So for listeners who don't necessarily know how homeopathy functions,
it doesn't.
End of discussion. But it's based on the principle of like for like, which there is a established model for in medicine. A lot of sort of like the flu jab contains a small amount of the flu virus because it makes your cells learn how to deal with it and combat it. You know, that sort of concept does exist in medical science. But what Heinemann chose to interpret from that is that... And in looking into this, because what I wanted to do was to give you, here are the standard ways in which homeopaths do their practice, and there aren't any standard ways. there's no unifying factor between the way anything is prepared. But the basic principles are: you take a very small amount of something that is causing somebody harm, whether that be an actual disease or a bit of a tree, and you dilute that in water repeatedly to various different concentrates. But generally speaking, homeopathic medicines are diluted in water to the point where you cannot trace molecules of the original component that you're diluting. You dilute it to the point, you know. So homeopathic medicines vary in how much they are diluted, but many of them are diluted to where it's literally a drop in the ocean in terms of how much is contained from the original.
If you want to hide a trace amount of marshmallow plant, the homeopaths are the guys to go to.
So he like for like, very unobtrusive. What homeopaths don't talk about these days is all of the other things he said you had to do while you were taking homeopathic medicine, which included go outside and have some fresh air, and also included no pornography and no wanking.
I was out.
Yes.
Because I'd like to sell today my new book, Ben van der Velde's Wank Yourself Healthy.
It was a page turner.
But I like the idea that Heinemann, part of his quote unquote scientific treatment is like your dad when you're 30. Go outside, stop laying about, blame yourself,
walk it off.
Yeah.
Or in Ben's terms, wank it off.
Yeah, wank it off.
That's Taylor Swift's new X-rated
wank it off.
Wank it off. Shaker's gonna shake. Players gonna play with themselves. Why do I know these lyrics? But it's all sorts of quackery associated with the original so-called science of homeopathy. One of Heinemann's other theories is that he sort of thought that coffee was evil and caused a lot of diseases. He had a really big thing about coffee that he worked on for years and then just abandoned, going, nope, this is bullshit. He had the good grace to step away from that particular one. Homeopathy has continued because it got that initial air of respectability back in the 19th century, because it was unobtrusive compared to other things.
Yeah.
But
and it does have that thing of going, we're looking to the natural world for solutions, which is very new age.
Yes.
That carried on the 60s, and even now we're trying to get away from synthetic stuff, so it has that sort of air of, oh, this must have some benefit to it.
Yeah, and the idea of alternative medicine, which to be clear, is medicine that has not yet been proved to work.
So it's missing the word "to" in between alternative and medicine.
Yeah, I don't think it's right to call alternative medicine.
Yeah.
I think all alternative medicine, aisles and wherever you buy this shit should just have a thing above the aisle that just says, maybe try this.
Serving suggestion only.
Yes. Or just quackery. So
and instead of a kite mark, just have a duck printed on it.
Yeah. So it built up this initial air of respectability because of its unobtrusiveness, but also because of the way that homeopathy does, people who take homeopathic remedies report positive effects, and there's certain reasons for this. Biggest reason is the placebo effect, which is basically your mind has a lot of power over your body, if you think you are taking something, if you genuinely believe it will make you better, it will to a certain extent make you feel better, brackets for minor illnesses. People are getting rid of tumours because they think that they've had a nice little glass of water.
You say that, but I'm here to promote my book, Think Yourself Healthy. Tumour be gone.
The pages turn very nicely
out. People love to impose mysticism on things that they can't draw connections between. And if you believe something is going to make you healthier to a certain extent, it will. And also, I found out doing some research, a placebo effect could be transferred from parent onto child. If a parent thinks something will make their child better within a certain set of parameters, it will make their child better because the child picks up on the signals being given.
So it's like psychologically
ill. Placebo effect is all in your head, and there are studies still being done, but there are great studies on the placebo effect and how much the placebo effect accounts for so much mysticism and quackery that people think makes them
the color of the pill that you give people in a placebo trial can make a difference to how much more healthy they feel
and how many pills that don't contain anything apart from sugar,
and if it's an injection you tend to feel healthier than if you're given a pill it's amazing.
One of the other ways in which homeopathy is part of the reason people feel better when they've been given homeopathic medicines is just time. If you have a cold and you wait 2 weeks, you will feel better. But if you're taking homeopathic medicine and you think that's making you feel better, you'll draw a connection between those things that aren't connected. So time is a big part of this.
And, consuming fluids while you have a cold isn't a bad thing.
Yes, exactly, yes, because it is just water. But also, and this is an interesting aspect of modern medicine, these days, part of why homeopathic treatments, patients sort of feel like they have had some benefits from them, is the NHS is a creaky oiled machine trying to be as efficient as possible because it's trying to take care of an aging population. It's run in a very particular way because it's trying to look after the entire population of Great Britain. So you see your doctor for not a very long period of time. When you go and see a homeopath, it's a very long, involved, personal sort of assessment they give you, and it's almost like therapy. And that attention and that assessment and their sort of inquiring as to your well-being can have massively beneficial effects if you're feeling unwell. So that's part of the... But all of these things are in the people taking homeopathic medicines' heads. They've got nothing to do with the actual pills that they're taking, which are just mostly water. It's a tiny amount of something diluted in water that could be the same as diluting something in the ocean. Also, just to add to the quackery, they shake homeopathic medicine while it's being made because that makes the water remember. And I think... in the original descriptions of how you were meant to make these medicines, you were meant to specifically knock it against a saddlebag on a horse, because obviously,
that's why they don't work, because we don't have saddlebags anymore.
Yes, well, they've lost their powers. But also, so the like-for-like principle that it's based on, they've taken a really warped definition of that. Also, if water remembers everything that's diluted into it, a tiny amount, then it would have catastrophic effects on your health every time you drunk it because of the amount of oil and human shit and toxic waste that's been dumped in the oceans.
But then again, if you look at the entirety of human history, you could make the argument that that is what water has done.
We're getting worse because we keep drinking this shit. Oh my God.
Back on the beer and gin, lads.
Yeah. Ben, you've convinced me.
we go to 1974, and an immunologist called William Summerlin, who was working out of the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and he was conducting research into transplantation immunology and how patients would recover if they had something transplanted onto them, particularly skin transplants, and to try and stop skin transplants being rejected. And the way he tried to do this was by taking the skin cells from black mice and transplanting them onto white mice. And it's the pigmentation is called melanocyte. And the idea was that over time, the melanocytes would sort of migrate out of the transplanted tissue and into the original tissue in the donor mouse, and so it produced sort of like a greyish patch where the black would bleed into the white, and it would show by pigmentation that this worked. Turns out that Mr. Summerlin was somewhat of a quack, because whilst it appeared that it was successful, what he'd actually done is he'd taken a black permanent marker and he'd coloured in white mice.
No!
And yeah, it was only discovered after some animal care technicians basically had a close look at it, got some rubbing alcohol, and managed to just rub the marker pen off the mice. Good. He clearly, I imagine, was influenced by...
They became suspicious when all of the mice had moustaches and Harry Potter glasses.
Yeah. One of them had a West Ham scarf as well. He was probably influenced by an Austrian scientist called Paul Kammerer. And he designed an experiment to prove something called Lamarckian inheritance, which was... sort of related to the notion of... not survival of the fittest, but of the way genes propagate.
Yeah.
What's the word I'm talking about that genes have?
Genetics.
No.
Pockets.
No, the way that you can inherit characteristics, and you acquire them. So,
your genetic makeup as given to you by your parents through DNA.
Genetic inheritance.
Yeah, precisely.
Let's call it that. Yes.
Yeah, cool.
I think we've just invented something new, guys.
Yeah, we might have done.
Quicker than mice.
get a mouse and colour it in.
By the way, can I just say, taking pigmentation from black mice and put it into white mice, it's mouse get out. One of the mice ran up to another mouse and went, eep, eep.
And if you film that on a version of the board game Mousetrap... we're just tinkling a tiny little thimble full of tea.
Do you think Walt Disney was working on the theory behind that, and before these guys worked on the practice of it, just drawing black and white mice?
Oh my god, well, if you look at Mickey, he's got a white face but black all around the outside. It's an enormous allegory.
Get out! Oh.
Anyway, pass me my tinfoil colander. So anyway, this Austrian chap, Paul Kammerer, who was a renowned speech impediment. He was experimenting with midwife toads, and the toads... I can feel that you want to make a joke there, so feel free to.
Why do they need midwives?
No. The type of toad was called a midwife toad.
Yeah, I know, but why are they called midwife toads?
Someone's got to look after all the spawn.
Yeah, but the spawn looks after itself, doesn't it?
Oh, well, that's just the sort of irresponsible patriarchal
man's attitude to parents.
Once it's in the spawn, it doesn't need anyone looking after it, right? I can go watch telly.
And this is why we have so many delinquent tadpoles wandering around the ponds of Great Britain. Just, have you ever seen a tadpole with a shiv and some crack? No, because they don't have hands. But the point still stands.
That's very apologies for this, Barry, because I'm about to do a bad Irish accent.
Please, but, by all means.
But when I broke my leg and I was in hospital, I came round for my anaesthetic to see the most sturdy Irish midwife I have ever seen in my entire life. Not that I've seen many, but she was stood at the foot of my bed and she went, "Hello there, Mr. Bennett. What's going to happen is we're going to take care of you and we're going to make you dinner like your mammy used to make."
Hang on, you'd broken your leg and you had a midwife there.
Oh yeah, that's a ward sister, not a midwife.
I'm going to cut this baby out of here. Yeah. Now we've broken the leg, we'll snap it off completely.
That's the point. She was so stern, if she had said, "We're going to take this baby out of you," I'd have said, "Yeah, fine." Midwife. This is why I shouldn't get up on Monday mornings.
very silly story.
Midwife.
Midwife Toad.
Or fiance, as they call it.
And that's how I met my midwife.
Now, as I'm sure you're both aware, most toads mate in water.
Yeah.
But midwife toads...
Sorry, did you insinuate that me and Barry fuck toads?
Well, he's clearly got an entire family of tadpoles that he's neglecting.
Yeah, my secret tadpole, my secret toad wife.
Yeah, you're only in bed with another toad. The other toad opens the door.
God. Nothing's happening. She pulls open the bedside table, there's a drawer full of spawn. What do you call this? It's only spunk, I promise, it's only spunk.
I can explain.
Yeah, and then they look under your pillows and there's a copy of The Frog Princess. Oh, Barry, how could you?
I thought they would become a prince.
If only.
Well, no,
no, I've been kissing all those ugly men in the hope they turn back into toads.
Well, no, but isn't the tricky thing, on toads, like one of those species that can change gender?
I mean, anyone sex. Can now. They...
Sorry, let's not go down the path of gender reassignment. Yeah. Don't,
gender's no. a spectrum, Ben. Come on.
Sorry, sex. They can.
Sex is also a spectrum.
Sex is also a spectrum. No, nevertheless, toads can change their sex.
Yes.
What I'm saying is that's going to be troublesome for Barry if halfway through fucking a toad, it suddenly turns into a lady.
No, no. With toads, I'm bisexual.
Oh, okay. <that's...
laughs> Strictly humans.
Yeah.
Anyway,
what about these midwife toads, Ben?
So, as you're both aware,
this is the worst adaptation of The Wind in the Willows I've ever seen.
Push, bah, bah.
Why aren't there any mid-husband toads?
I don't know.
When is international mid-husband toad?
Where's international toad?
There's not. I mean, Barry's motto is: "There's nothing in the world as much fun as messing about in toads." Anyway,
we never get to the end of the
we
story.
We absolutely are.
Podcast is never ending.
As you're both aware, most toads mate in water. Now, Alexander knows this because he is a student of natural history, and Barry knows this because he's a fucking deviant. And when they mate in water, it results in scaly black bumps on their hind limbs, which allow them to hold on to each other during mating, or for randy Irish homosexuals to grab hold on.
Hang on, where do these scaly black bumps come from? Are they allergic to water? It makes the bumps appear? Or are they really into S&M and they have to whack each other's arses to bring up these welts?
No, I think that...
Because that's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you do too much S&M with a toad, then it just explodes.
Yeah, 50 toads of grey.
It's always terrible when your S&M partner explodes. Or brilliant. Depending on what you do.
Have we had a fundamental misunderstanding of what ISIS are up to? That's why they blow themselves up in places like Berlin.
It's just a really elaborate role play.
Yeah.
That's why they're making all of that amateur stuff and uploading it online.
Okay, so let me get this straight.
ISIS is S&M that got out of hand. It's the greatest.
That's the hot take.
Don't wake me off in the van. Oh no! Oh well, we'll have to double down on it now. Will people know what we've been up to?
Suicide bombing is just wanking. Is that their version of wanking? Yeah. So ISIS fuck toads in water with black welts. That's what we've learned.
Yeah. Yes.
And they need a midwife on hand to make them food like their mothers make.
That seems to be an excellent summary of what we've got through in the past 5 minutes.
What's just happened in the last 10 minutes? It's all a dream. You were there and you were there. And you were there.
So... Most toads.
Podcast award, please. Podcast award.
Do people in ISIS doing S&M have to bum towards Mecca?
I think we found the line. I think we found the line.
Uh.
and breathe. So...
What the fuck does that have to do with scientific frauds? Oh, hang on, why are we talking about toads having sex?
I will get there.
Will you?
I don't know. Most toads mate in water.
We're in a fucking time loop.
Most toads mate in water.
It's taken on such a sinister moment.
Most toads mate in water, which results in scaly black bumps on their hind legs.
We know this!
I know! I'm just...
We know it because he's a student of natural history and I fuck toads. Something right. About ISIS.
Yeah. But midwife toads mate on land.
Yes. We know this.
So they don't have these lumps.
Mm-hmm.
So what Camera wanted to do, his idea was that by forcing midwife toads to mate in water, which is a terrifying sentence when you think about it, just grabbing these toads and shoving them in the water and going, fuck, damn you, fuck! This is the name of science, but I'm doing all that in an Austrian accent, which is even creepier.
No, leave them, they're into it.
Yeah. Sorry, ironically, I got a frog in my throat. So he thought that they would develop the same bumps by making them fuck in water. So he mated a number of generations of toads in a fish tank full of water, and he announced that he'd succeeded, and they had black bumps on their hind limbs.
Where he was gripping them.
I wish that were the case.
Toady love handles.
Yeah. But it turned out, much like our friend with the mice, what he'd actually done is just injected black ink into their back and their legs to create these lumps.
That's so sad.
It is so sad. He insisted he hadn't injected ink into the toads and suggested one of his lab assistants might have done it. They denied it. Camera committed suicide a few days later, having been accused of this hoax.
Oh, wow, that's a bit drastic.
It is a little bit
drastic.
Only
toads.
Yeah, firstly, I had sympathy for the toads, and then I have sympathy for the fraud.
Yeah, it's a much more nuanced story than I thought it was when we first started on 25 years ago, man. Yeah.
You should have been a lot more respectful.
Yeah. I can't imagine what we wouldn't have said if we'd have known that. So it's only... I think the worst thing is the saddest part is all of these ISIS midwife bride toads.
What, who've had their citizenship revoked by the Home Office?
The stateless toads.
Yes, and also by the Environment Agency as well. But that's not my suggestion.
No?
No. I'm going to go to the Soviet Union and be inspired by a gentleman called Trofim Lysenko. Who developed Lysenkoism, and he served as the director of the USSR's Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences.
That's such a Soviet institute name, isn't it?
Yeah, it may as well have just been Lenin Marx Trotsky Society of Proletarian...
Comrades, comrades.
Yeah. And he was actually influenced by Lamarckism, this idea of heritability of acquired characteristics. And basically, he propagated this pseudoscience that stood in the way of everything Charles Darwin had said and everything that Gregor Mendel had said about genetics. Some of the things he suggested was that rye could transform into wheat and wheat into barley. Not true. That weeds could spontaneously transmute into food grains. Also not true. And that natural cooperation was observed in nature as opposed to natural selection. Slightly true if you watch certain cuddly Facebook videos of like an elk and a crocodile becoming best buddies out of nowhere.
Yes.
Particularly out of nowhere because they live in different countries. And he promised extraordinary advances in breeding and in agriculture if people followed what he did. Stalin supported the campaign, and when Stalin supports a campaign, that means trouble for someone. More than 3,000 mainstream biologists were either fired or sent to the gulags, and anyone who suggested that Lysenko's findings were total bullshit was basically either ignored or sent off to prison. And he was responsible for some of the biggest famines in the history of the Soviet Union, where millions upon millions of people died, because on top of the collectivization that was going on, where the agriculture wasn't being done in a particularly efficient way, he was putting in place all sorts of, in his ideas, modern communist agricultural techniques that just weren't working. Lysenko was admitted into the highest hierarchy of the Communist Party and used his position to denounce other biologists who were correct scientists, and he described them as fly lovers and people haters and wreckers.
Wow. I'll tell you who else is a fly lover.
There was a comedian who swallowed a fly, then he swallowed a toad. He'll swallow anything. He won't spit.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why you're into toads, the length of the tongue on them.
But never quite long enough.
No, but the problem is it's just in and out, job done. But he kept denouncing anyone whose agricultural theories disagreed with him as either being bourgeois or fascist.
Sounds like a very familiar technique, that.
Yeah.
Don't agree with me. Well, you're a fascist.
Yep. My favourite description of Stalin's approach to denouncing scientists was this. There's a historian called Tony Judd who said, it's significant that Stalin purged almost everyone in the scientific community apart from nuclear physicists, who he left alone and never presumed to second-guess their calculations. Stalin may well have been mad, but he was not stupid. The worst bit, I didn't realise this until I just read this, when Chairman Mao took over in China, China looked at what Russia was doing with its agricultural policies and went, oh, this seems great, and so applied them in China, and tens of millions of Chinese people died due to starvation as well.
Yeah.
So, what an awful man.
He franchised it out.
He absolutely did. And if Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister, then we can look forward to Lysenkoism being put in place. That's just a little thing there for our right-wing listeners.
Another thing for them, Jeremy Corbyn likes homeopathy as well.
Does he?
Yeah.
And he's going to be, Prince Charles is going to be king, Jeremy Corbyn's going to be Prime Minister.
What a weird world.
Yeah, brave new world, by Aldous Huxley, will become a real thing.
Yeah, and John McDonnell actually believes you can extract gold from the sea.
The Red Sea.
The Red
Sea.
Our suggestions this week for the world's worst scientific fraud are Barry's of the very Reverend Prescott Ford Jernigan, who managed to extract gold from the sea and, more importantly, from his investors before skedaddling away. Alexander's suggestion of the enormous historical canard of homeopathy, or my suggestion of the deadliest farmer in the world, Trofim Lysenko. Strong suggestions, lads. I mean, Alexander's is the most infuriating that it still exists in the modern world.
Yeah.
Mine is the most horrifying, and yours, Barry, is the funniest.
Yeah. We're going to get gold from the sea.
Yeah. I mean, because what we look for on this podcast is heroic failure, yeah. And there's nothing heroic about what Trofim Lysenko did.
This is true.
It's a catastrophic failure.
Yeah.
All. I mean, you know, world's worst. I mean, you know, in terms of active harm caused, it's pretty up there.
He's right up there with John R. Brinkley, the guy who invented... not Brinkley. I'm mixing up the wrong guy. Who's the guy who's the worst environmentalist?
Thomas Midgley.
Thomas Midgley, who invented CFCs and
leaded petrol.
Yeah, that's a hell of a twofer.
Crazy,
yeah.
Environmentalism.
He's like the anti-Richard O'Brien. Richard O'Brien wrote the Rocky Horror Show and hosted the Crystal Maze. If you've done two things in your career, that's pretty damn good.
I was going to say, I didn't realise that Richard O'Brien was a massive environmentalist.
Massive environmental catastrophes.
Well, no.
Both of them.
How do you feel about toads?
Fish, yeah. Fishnets.
That's where he keeps his toes.
Yeah.
Homeopathy is absolutely infuriating, but it is a really good dickhead monitor. Yeah. Like if you're out on a date with someone,
oh, yeah, that's
or
good.
And you're kind of like, so you know, what are your interests, what are your belief systems, mm-hmm. and everything. It's like, I'm really into homeopathy. You're like, well, I am out.
Yeah, it's like you need that quality control system in place.
Yeah. Whereas,
as do scientists for any medicine that they say works.
Yes.
Whereas extracting gold from the sea is such a magnificent blag. Yes. I so admire it. Even though they were essentially just awful fraudulent men, that I'm going to pick that.
Yes, the Electrolytic Marine Salts Company.
Well done, the Electrolytic
Marine Salts Company. Back in business. Get the mill running.
Don't look at the business.
Yeah, don't look at the business. Invest in the business, don't look at the business. Look around the business. Don't look at the business, look at the brand business.
Before we go, it's time for the world's worst news of the week. And this is quite a vague piece of news that I found, but it so delighted me that I had to share it. Details are emerging of a metal detector enthusiast needing the assistance of the emergency services after digging a 12-foot hole after his metal detector started giving a huge reading, indicating that he could be standing on a vast amount of treasure. However, it appeared that he forgot that he was wearing steel toe-cap boots.
Amazing.
And just kept digging and digging and digging. Until he couldn't get out of the hole.
Then he got out, they filled the hole in, realised he'd left his metal detector down. Had to buy a metal detector to find the metal detector.
God, and was trapped in the same loop that we were in with those fucking toes.
I reckon that he realised 6 foot down what had happened, and then went, everyone's going to think I'm such a twat if I tell them what I've done. So kept digging in the hope of finding something. And then had to give up another 6 foot down. So I will have to concede, mate. It's my boots.
Before we go, Alexander, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
I am at Alexi Bennett on Twitter. You can watch stand-up shows I've done on nextupcomedy.com. I'm going to the Edinburgh Fringe. I'll be on at 7 p.m. at the Waverley Bar and at the Liquid Room Annex at 10:30 p.m. with my silly game show. Also doing a one-off show at the Pleasance Ground on the 14th at 1:30.
Yeah, do buy tickets for that because it's, what, 800 seats?
It's 750-seat theatre.
Yeah, the absolute fear in Alexander's eyes of what have I done is wonderful. Brilliant. We're all off to the local vivarium. Strap-ons at the ready, boys. We're going to get two toads at a time. Until next time.
Bye. Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.